is the theme song of David Letterman's Late Night with David Letterman show on NBC. It debuted in the early 80s. And, of course, between those years and all the years he put it on CBS, the man put in 33 years in late night television. And is now the subject of a terrific biography written by Jason Zinnemann, who the New York Times has made their first ever comedy correspondent and columnist. The book is called Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night, and I've invited Jason to come on here today and talk a little bit about the late night legend. Hi, Jason. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on the show.
David Letterman turned 70 years old on Wednesday, and one of the things about this book that I found most interesting is that this is not an unauthorized biography, because you actually got to sit down with him. He knew you were doing the book. He cooperated, as did many of the people who worked with him over the course of the last three decades, right?
He did. This is sort of a technical point. It's not an authorized biography, but it's a biography that was done with his cooperation. I talked to him, and I talked to hundreds of people who worked with him and were close to him over his long career.
Okay, so I'm curious, having read the book, which I really enjoyed, was it harder for you to get David Letterman to sit down for interviews, or to get his old show-running girlfriend, Meryl Marco, to give you parts of her diary to publish in your book?
That is actually a fantastic question. And it is a tough one. The honest answer to that is the diaries. Because Letterman actually never said no. I asked, of course, at the beginning of the process, and he didn't say yes. It took him a long time before he agreed to do it. But he never said no. The diaries I knew of for a while, and I asked to see them, because, I mean, there's nothing better than a primary source. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to hear somebody's memory about what happened 30 years ago, but to see actually what they wrote about meeting David Letterman at the Comedy Store in, 1978, you can't beat that. It wasn't until, talking to her and kind of working sources and sort of establishing a relationship that late in the process she finally did allow me to see that. But you have an eagle eye. That was a tremendously tough part of the reporting.
Well, I figured it was, because I've interviewed Meryl a few times, and she's come out with several books through the years, and she's been on publicity tours. I've had the chance to talk to her, and I always felt like I had to tread lightly on the David Letterman subject. So, I mean, you not only got her to open up, but literally to open up her diary and tell you stories about their relationship. How much credit do you give her for his success?
I mean, I think, in terms of the early show, which I would argue is the foundation of his entire reputation, she probably deserves a half the credit. Now, of course, she was gone by the late 80s, so, the rest of his career is different. But, I mean, she came up with Viewer Mail, she came up with Stupid Petricks, she edited and really came up with the concepts for a lot of the remotes. She was the original head writer. She hired many of the great writers from the Harvard Lampoon who made some of the best satire, and just generally, somebody who talked to most of the original writing staff and the people who worked on the show, like Hal Gurney, including David Letterman, almost everyone will say the same story, which is, this was, her vision was integral, particularly when it comes to the more adventurous kind of form-breaking work. And if you look at, what made David Letterman different than everybody else, there's many things, but I think a lot of the really irreverent kind of anti-talk show sort of material, he needed someone to push him to get to do that. Because I think on a fundamental level, Letterman was torn between doing the more irreverent stuff and putting on a more traditional talk show like Johnny Carson.
Yeah. Well, his show actually did become a lot more traditional after moving to CBS. But in the book, you write about the NBC years at length, and you say that there were three distinct eras in that decade that he was on NBC. What were those?
Well, these three periods, and this is, you know, why I started the process. Is I went back and I watched all the shows. There's many that I could find, And what I discovered is that, you know, you had this period starting with the morning show in 1980, which was kind of a test run for the late night show, which started in 82. From 1980 to 1984, it was a very writerly show. It was a very satirical about talk shows, very experimental. You constantly was changing the point of view from the show would start from Dave's point of view. Sometimes the show would start from the point of view of the guy in the back of the room. And Letterman himself was a more restrained presence. He actually seemed more like a normal man surrounded by this crazy show. The middle, once he became a hit and had some success, the middle period from like 84 to 88, that's when he started doing throwing himself up against a Velcro wall and doing kind of stunts like Steve Allen, and the show getting much bigger and having more spectacle. Hal Gurney coming up with the monkey cam, this kind of thing, and also his sort of his sarcastic sense of humor became something he pursued more, making fun of jokes that bomb you and getting jokes more from that than from punchlines. And then around 88, which the writer's strike, I put down that the writers in the show became less important, and Letterman's personality became center stage. So the show became a little more spontaneous, a little more of Letterman talking to the camera, telling stories. And what you see is that the show became less about the writers and more about the theater of his fascinating and difficult personality.
Difficult personality is a good way to put it. The one word that rings true to me throughout this book, and you use it a couple of times, and I think it probably applies much more to the second half, but we're certainly present in the first half of those 33 years, that word is misery. This is a man who was pretty miserable the entire time, right?
Yep. I mean, I think that this is one of the things that was, I think, hard for me to understand, because, you know, there was a, you know, he thought he was, every show he thought was terrible, and he was a relentlessly self-critical person, which I think is part of what made him great, because he, you know, was a perfectionist and kept pushing the show, but moreover, he turned this kind of neuroses into comedy, as, you know, a lot of great comedians do. But yeah, I mean, you know, I would ask, you know, every head writer would have the same story, which is that, you know, Letterman was just relentless in how terrible things were. And, you know, this is at the same time when the show was fantastic and the show was coming up with brilliant ideas. But, you know, I think temperamentally, he wasn't feeling that.
How was that?
He has said, I think, in recent years, he has said he has a, you know, depressive streak.
How was that for them? What kind of a work environment is that?
I think, you know, it's a complicated thing because, I you know, he actually was harder on himself than on others. He wasn't, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of bosses, particularly in show business, who take their, you know, anger out on people below them. Letterman didn't do that. He took it out on himself. And in a way, that's obviously better to work for than the alternative. On the other hand, I do think after 33 years of it, it created a certain mood, and that was fearful and negative. And I think some people, particularly in the later years, you know, found that difficult to work for. The talk show is a strange form because it's this big, complicated apparatus with all these different people. But at the center is one person. It all filters through this one person. So if this one person has a very negative personality, it could have an impact on the whole operation.
You write in the book about, as years went by, he started withdrawing more and more from his own staff. At a point, he wasn't having any contact with pretty much anybody except his close core of maybe four or five people. So I wonder what it was like for the people who were outside of that, who had to put up with this miserable boss of theirs, but never really had to see this miserable boss of theirs and never really had to deal with him.
Well, there's a certain amount of, you know, this is a term that gets thrown around occasionally. I've heard it at the New York Times, too, where you don't really see the editor-in-chief too often. You know, you see where it's called Kremlinology, where you sit around kind of guessing what's going on. You know, you're guessing what the boss thinks. When there's an absence of information, then what fills that hole? Well, gossip and speculation and, you know, a lot of things that some may be true, may not be true, politics, you know. So, for instance, how this plays out in a concrete way is that this is, of course, in the later period. If you were trying to pitch an ambitious comedy idea that required, you know, getting a camera and people to go somewhere, if you couldn't get him on the phone to get the approval and there was always a chance that he'd kill it at the end of the process, you know, you might be more cautious about proposing something like that.
So it had
an effect on everything.
Speaking of effect on everything, I can tell you, I'm a little bit older than you. You write in the book about how you were first exposed to Letterman when you were in high school. I was already working in radio by the time Dave came on the air with his morning show and then with his late night show. That sensibility, some people called it the new irony. I don't buy that. But that new comedic sensibility that he was bringing to television not only affected what came after him in television, but also affected radio. I mean, I know people who to this day are still doing a David Letterman impression on the air with their bits and with their material and even with their delivery. Mm-hmm. What do you think was the impact of what Letterman was doing 30 years ago on the people who are now doing late night television shows, and there are so many of them?
Oh, well, huge impact. I mean, you said a lot of smart things there. I mean, one is that radio, as you know, is key to understanding Letterman. You know, he started when he was born, there was no television in his household. He wanted to be in radio, and that's key to understanding him. Two, what influence does he have on people today? I mean, in some ways, very direct kind. If you see, like, when Jimmy Fallon inhales helium with his guests, and they do a bit with that. Letterman did that in the 80s. When James Corden, in one of his first weeks, took his camera and set up his whole show inside a stranger's house, Letterman did that in his morning show. If you look at the remotes that Conan does fantastically, or The Daily Show does, now, Steve Allen did things outside before Letterman, but there's a direct line between the sophistication of Letterman's remotes and the remotes of Conan and The Daily Show. So he had a huge impact on that. Now, to the last point you made about irony, I agree with you that there was nothing new about what he was doing. You know, irony, Dave Letterman didn't invent irony, but there was a certain kind of ironic detachment that he, I would argue, mainstreamed, because he brought it into your living room every single night. And the relationship between the viewer and a talk show host is very intimate. And I think that's part of the reason why there's so many people who imitate him, because they watched him night after night, and they got a sense of what was cool from what this guy, what his attitude was. And his attitude was, you know, everyone was a kind of ironic, sarcastic sensibility that telegraphed this idea that everything around him was phony.
Mm-hmm. There's one other thing, and by the way, I'm a longtime Letterman fan. Even in the last 10 years of his show, when it was barely worth watching most nights, I still recorded it and would fast forward through it and look for sparks of what I called the old Dave. But
yeah,
there's one other thing that I consider him responsible for to the detriment of late night television, and that is there are no surprises anymore.
Mm.
You know, I just showed a couple of the guys I work with a clip from a Carson show from 40 years ago where Dom DeLuise was on and he was doing a funny stunt with eggs and things, and Johnny was there, and the stunt devolved into essentially an egg-throwing fight, which was not what it was meant to be. And you know, by watching it, Carson doesn't exactly know what's going to happen next. He hasn't seen this stunt played out. Rehearsal for this didn't exist. They were just going with it and creating something new. David
right.
Letterman hated that, didn't he?
Yes. This is a very important point. Because there's an incongruity between what David Letterman does well and what he thinks he does well. So he is a spectacular, like Johnny was, a spectacular ad-libber. And in the morning show and in the early late-night show, his staff would surprise him. For the greatest example, and you can find it on YouTube, I think, is there was a show in the morning show where the staff locked the door that he needed to open to go in to do his monologue. And they, Hal Gurney set up a camera backstage up high so you could see him struggling to get the Canada door open and then, you know, panic. He had no idea that was going to happen. Letterman hated that kind of thing. And I track in the book how, you know, that sort of those kind of surprises stopped. There's one moment with a giant doorknob, which was a running bit they had in the show, where Meryl Marco put in the an elevator when he was out doing a bit out there. That was an elevator opened, and there was a doorknob. He wasn't expecting it. And he was really furious about that. And, you know, from that point on, they weren't surprised. And when there was, like, for instance, when Crispin Glover came on and sort of was acting crazy and kicked him, he just walked off the screen.
Yeah.
He walked off the camera. I mean, it's remarkable because, you know, he could have come up with a clever line or played with it, but that's not how he wanted to do the show.
You write in the book about not only what he didn't want to do, but what then impacted what we see now, which is a complete lack of spontaneity. And you've mentioned the name Hal Gurney three times. Hal Gurney was the director for the entire run on NBC. I don't know, did he go to the Ed Sullivan Theater with him?
He did. He left a few years into it.
Okay. Talk about his contribution to what we saw that was also, with Meryl Marco, part of creating the Letterman legend.
A major unsung figure in the history of television. I mean, there's no greater director in the history of talk shows, and that is not, I think most people can name a talk show director. They don't usually get credit for much. Hal Gurney got laughs that no other show would get. You know, he was sort of famous for something, for a cutaway shot, which would be, you'd be, you know, a Letterman would be talking to somebody or it'd be in a remote and there would be something going on, and he would cut away from the action for no reason whatsoever and show you somebody watching the action. You'd think that wouldn't have much of a big impact, but it's amazing how many laughs you get over that. For instance, when Madonna went on his show and was cursing up a storm, and here you have Madonna, who's maybe one of the most famous people in America, and Letterman, another one of the most famous people in America, only Hal Gurney has the guts to cut away from that to an older lady in the audience watching them. And gets a huge laugh.
Yep.
That's just one example of just an incredibly playful, creative way Hal Gurney directed the show. And he did it because, one, he had experience. He was Jack Parr's director, so Letterman, you know, had respect for him. He knew that, you know, he knew what he was doing. But also, he, like Letterman, had the sort of, although he seemed like a, you know, an avuncular, sweet guy, older guy, at least compared to other people on the show. You know, he really had the, you know, he had the heart of an anarchist, that guy. And he liked to, you know, go against the grain and blow stuff up. And it's part of what made Late Night such a great, unpredictable show.
Do you still have your autographed can of Spam, Jason?
I do.
Was it really signed by Letterman?
It was not. That was one thing I learned, is that you're referring to this one. I went to see Letterman as my summer before going off to college, and I went to see him. It was the second week on CBS, and I asked an usher for an autograph, and the usher told me I can get an autograph if I can get a can of Spam before the doors open in 10 minutes. So I ran around Times Square from bodega to bodega to bodega. It's not easy to get a can of Spam, I've learned, in Times Square. But I eventually just found it, and I rushed back, and I gave it to the usher. And then after the show, I waited around, and he came out, and he gave me this can of Spam. And on it said, David Letterman, I loves my Spam. And I was thrilled, and I took it to college, and I put it above my desk, and I kept it there for years and years. When I moved to New York, I kept it there. It was one of my most prized possessions. And when I finally did meet or interview Letterman, at the end of the interview, I asked him about it because I thought, well, maybe this was like a regular thing they did, is get people to sign Spam. And before I got the question out, he started shaking his head, and it was clear that he didn't sign Spam. He had a staff member sign it. But it was a great story, and at the end of the day, it turned into a very good anecdote for the book.
It is a terrific book. It's simply called Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. This is Jason Zinnemann, the man who wrote it, and has so many wonderful stories in here. We don't even have time to get into David Letterman, the horny creep. We don't have time to get into some of the other NBC experiments he did, and so much more. It's a great read. I really enjoyed it, and I'm glad you could join me here to talk about it today, Jason. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.